versus Sandoval, Mr. Gutierrez.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court.
Hi.
Judges, I'm here to argue on behalf of Hector Sandoval, claiming that his trial was fundamentally flawed in a couple of very important ways. The first way that it was flawed is that the prosecutor made certain arguments which suggested to the jury facts that were not in evidence and facts that couldn't have been reasonably deduced or adduced from the testimony at trial. Specifically, the testimony that police saw Mr. Sandoval run to the back of the house, thereby implying that he had time to conceal a weapon. The second prong of that argument is
they didn't say that, did they?
They never said that he ran to the back of the house, but it was implied that he ran to the back of the house and go into a room, into a bedroom, where a weapon was found, and therein conceal that weapon.
That was implied with what he said that ran to the back of the house?
That's correct, Judge. That was exactly what was implied.
Okay.
And the other thing that was implied was that the victim, the so-called victim's wife, had seen Hector Sandoval holding a gun to her husband's head, thereby implying that he was a gun-toting kidnapper. Well, the testimony of Mrs. Rivas's wife, or of Mr. Rivas's wife, was that she saw a man standing there holding a small firearm.
But the testimony was different than the statement of the prosecutor.
That's correct, Judge.
I assume the jury heard both.
The jury heard both.
And if the final argument was available to your client.
The final argument was available to my client. That's correct. However, I don't believe that a prosecutor, both at trial and at sentencing, should have the creative license to make suggestions to a jury that do not logically follow from the evidence that was presented.
Well, they can reject it if they want, can't they? And they're told so.
That's correct. But when it's married to the second argument, that is, the argument that that my client did not have the opportunity to present his defense because he did not have a qualified interpreter, thereby tipping the
hand.
Can you point to any statements improperly translated by the interpreter, which under the plain error standard, unfortunately, which is what we have to deal with here, that would have affected the outcome of the trial?
First of all, Judge, I disagree with the plain error argument. I think it was raised at trial that the interpreter was flawed. And I think that objection was adequately preserved, so I think that that it's an abuse of discretion. But if you turn to page 28 of my appellant's brief, the court states as follows. Well, he seems to be saying what you're saying, what she seems to be having some trouble is understanding the nuances of what is being asked of her. That doesn't necessarily mean, in my mind, that you are translating wrong. And that's the sum and substance of my argument, Your Honor.
Yeah.
The sum and substance is how can someone be having trouble translating the nuances of language and yet at the same time being it...
You've just read an implication into what was said that may not be covered by what was said, which is precisely what you're complaining about the prosecutor did in the case below.
Well,
I'm just calling that your attention. We have to make a quantum leap to get to where you are from what was said by the court discussing the interpreter.
Well, that's just the framework, Judge. I understand what you're saying. The real point was...
See, you don't understand what
that's
I'm
right,
saying.
That's right, Judge. The main witness for the defendant, the alibi witness, was his wife, the defendant's wife. That was his only witness. He had one witness to put on to corroborate his story and his version of things. And that witness was trampled underfoot. First, by the interpreter, who could not catch the nuance of whether she was saying that her husband was with her on a certain day or was living with her on a certain day. Because that in Spanish, Judge, whether somebody's living there or somebody is merely there, staying there, that could be the same word. Not having listened to the actual testimony of the Spanish language, I could only...
Was there a tape recording of the, or transcript of the trial proceeding?
There was a transcript, Judge.
No, there was a tape recorder by the court reporter taken.
I'm assuming.
Well, so am I, because every court reporter in the federal system does that.
That's correct.
Did you listen to that tape?
I did not listen to that tape, Judge.
Did you subject that tape to any other interpreters?
All I have is the record.
All I have is the transcript.
That's right.
The transcript itself may or may not involve what you say.
That's correct, Judge.
Okay.
That's correct. But we have to look at it in totality. And the totality is that the only witness that my client had was subject to an inquisition of her truthfulness based upon what the court has already cited in this case was a mistaken nuance of what was being interpreted. And Judge, if my only client has one witness to put on the stand and that witness is discredited by the fatal flaw of an interpreter.
Well, that's what I said. If you had got the tape itself, that is not just the transcript, the tape itself, and discovered such a fatal flaw, you would be on solid ground. But what you have is a transcript that is subject to exactly what you're talking about. You have to allow for nuances in order for us to arrive at the conclusion you want us to. Because cross-examination of a witness, even if it's the only witness, is perfectly available and perfectly constitutional and all in good form, I would suggest.
But not when the prosecutor, I respectfully disagree, states on the record that he speaks the language and it is his opinion that the court interpreter is trying to cover up for the witness's lies.
Would that be all right if you had said it and you were the defense lawyer?
I doubt it.
Come on.
Judge, a prosecution has a higher calling. The prosecution's calling, sir, is that...
I agree with you. I was one. But I also want to know why you think he is not... If he speaks the language and thinks that something is wrong, he is unable to call it to somebody's attention. Well, just like you should have. Or
that's
should
correct.
Be fewer. You didn't try the case.
I didn't try the case, Judge.
I know you didn't.
But... I guess the point is well taken, Judge. The point is well taken, that if the defense counsel hears something and draws it to the court attention, then it's different than if the prosecutor draws it to the court attention and the judge buys into it. Now, how come the judge buys into what the prosecutor's saying without no basis of saying, well, I too speak the language, and I think that you're correct, Mr. Allegro? Okay? There's a big leap between merely the prosecutor saying, well, I speak the language.
You've been practicing law for some time. Have you ever used interpreters? Have you ever heard one not give the right answer, not interpret correctly?
Often.
Often.
Yes,
and you're calling the attention of somebody?
Yes, I do, Judge.
Attaboy.
Thank you.
I guess I'm going to go back to the remarks made by the prosecutor. And the bottom line question here is, would the outcome of the proceedings have been different absent the remarks? Which, here we certainly are dealing with the plain error standard, because you've got only one remark objected to.
Yeah, you're right. It is a plain error in that regard. And my read on this, of course, is that it would have been different, Judge. the evidence that was presented. In fact, at sentencing, Judge McDade says, as far as the weapon is concerned, the evidence about any weapon being held to Mr. Rivas' head is, in paraphrasing, slim or tenuous. In other words, perhaps there was greater evidence, because of the circumstances, that my client was there and he actively and knowingly participated in the kidnapping. There's no question that he was there because he was arrested there. So on that end, perhaps it's much more powerful to suggest that he was there and he participated in it. But in terms of actually carrying the gun and holding it to Mr. Rivas' head, that the court stated that the evidence on that was much weaker than the other aspect of the case, but nevertheless found for the gun enhancement, which added 10 years to the sentence. So that was a substantial portion of the argument that there was a run to the back room, time enough to hide the gun. None of the police said they saw my client with the gun. None of the policemen said they saw my client run out of the back bedroom, which would have suggested that in the time of the arrest, he could have gone to the back bedroom and hidden the gun where it was found. And certainly, Mr. Rivas' wife, she didn't say she saw Hector Sandoval with the gun pointed at Mr. Rivas' head. She said she saw someone. Now, there's a lot of evidence in this case that there were other people in this house, that there was at least one other person who had been in the basement, and simply because he was not arrested, there's never any other mention, neither by defense counsel, neither by prosecution, nobody mentioned the fact that there was another person in the house, that there was testimony by both Rivas, and I believe there was one other person who testified that at one time there was another, almost like a butler. He was opening doors for people, he was ushering people in, and he was downstairs in the basement. What happened to him? So I guess what I'm saying is that there was another person in the house who could have been the same person who Miss Rivas saw pointing a gun to her husband's head. So even the court below agreed that the evidence concerning the gun was rather slim.
Okay, that's it.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Gutierrez. Mr. Mahajko?
May it please the court, my name is John Mahajko. I'm an assistant United States attorney in the Central District of Illinois. I'd like to first address the prosecutorial misconduct allegations. The counsel discussed, and I'd like to talk about the interpreter issue.
I'm going to ask you, before you even start, if you would concede that it wasn't improper to comment on the experience of Chicago police officers to bolster their credibility that way. The prosecutor said that Chicago police officers have more common, that know more about human nature after working 2 months on the street than the rest of us put together in this courtroom.
Your Honor, I think you're referring to the vouching allegation that was raised below in the motion for a new trial. That is not an issue that's been raised on appeal here. But I'd like to first point that out.
Well,
second of all, I don't think there's any...
Surely it's part of the, remarks made by the prosecutors, part of the argument up here.
It was a remark made by the prosecutor, Your Honor, but there's been no argument that he improperly vouched or bolstered those officers' credibility. The argument that was made was the Vargas objection, that he said that the officers on the one hand saying, we saw him run when we came up the front steps. You got the defendant on the other hand saying, I didn't run to the back of the house. I was walking out the front door to get cigarettes.
And were you the prosecutor?
I was not, Your Honor.
Oh, okay.
The AUSA is just pointing out the inherent contradiction in those two stories, saying these officers are trained observers. They told you what they saw. The defendant told you what he supposedly did, and those are irreconcilable versions of what happened. You have to choose between the two. I don't think there's anything improper about what the prosecutor said in that case. I would like to address...
I'm taking my breath back.
Your Honor, I would like to address the allegation that there was no evidence that the defendant ran from police. As I pointed out in my brief, both officers testified that upon entering the house, the first officer, Sergeant Casey, said he saw people scurry towards the back of the house. Officer Nestad said he saw two men standing there who made eye contact, and then the two men ran to the back of the house, and another individual, later identified as Frank Rivas, ran towards us. Couldn't be clearer in the record that that's what those officers said. Both officers also testified that the defendant and Marcelo Sandoval would have had time from the time the officers came in the front door, intercepted Rivas, handcuffed him, and shoveled him back to the waiting officers. Both Marcelo and the defendant would have had time to run to the bedroom where the guns were found, ditch those guns in the dresser where they were recovered, and then proceed on to where the officers actually arrested them. That was in the record. It's clear as day. So the prosecutor's statement that the defendant ran was abundantly supported by the evidence at trial. As far as the argument that Michelle Rivas saw Hector pointing a gun at her husband, the prosecutor never said she testified that it was Hector. What he said was, Michelle saw a man holding a large black gun, the same gun that Frank Rivas identified the defendant as holding. Holding that gun pointed at her husband. She identified that man as not being Marcelo. And Marcelo and the defendant were the only two adult males arrested at the house a couple of minutes later after the Chicago police showed up. It's a fair inference from that evidence that Hector was the one holding a gun on Frank Rivas. And that's putting aside the fact that Frank Rivas testified he was holding a gun on me for 2 days while I was there. So that evidence was in the record, and the prosecutor's statements were supported by the record. As far as the interpreter issue goes, the Certified Interpreters Act does not always require a certified interpreter. The language of the Act is that a certified interpreter is to be used unless one is not reasonably available. In this case, there was both a certified interpreter interpreting for the defendant at the defense table and a non-certified interpreter who was brought in to interpret for one witness, and that was Ms. Avila, the defendant's girlfriend. The defendant did not object to the use of a non-certified interpreter. He did raise an issue with the court about, originally this whole issue came about the prosecutor's objection that the non-certified interpreter was helping the defendant's girlfriend in her testimony, saying, I don't think she understands the question. That's what sparked the whole colloquy with the court here. Defendant's interpreter jumped in and said, I don't think he's helping her. And then comes up with this, 10 pages back in the transcript, he may have misinterpreted one word, father-in-law for brother-in-law, brother-in-law for father-in-law. The transcript reflects that there was no error, and even if there was an error, that was a completely irrelevant subject in this case. The certified interpreter, the person whose qualifications, certification, the defendant upholds the touchstone of reliability, could not point to any other alleged mistranslation in this case. The district court also made findings that he had no basis to say that the interpreter wasn't translating correctly. I think based on that record, it was not error to keep the certified interpreter in there, no airplane or otherwise. I've addressed the sufficiency of the indictment and or sufficiency of the evidence argument in my brief, as well as the venue question. I think that's fairly well covered in the brief. Unless the court has any further questions for me, I'd return the balance of my time and ask the court to affirm the judgment of the district court.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Mahajko.
Thank you.
Mr. Gutierrez, how much time does he have? 3 minutes?
So it's just a couple things more concerning the comments about the two mistakes that were pointed out. There are errors which need not be quantitative, but that are qualitative, so that they rise to the level of creating an atmosphere or creating a situation where the court adopts the the argument by the prosecutor, and that is that Mr. or Mrs. Sandoval was trying to cover up for her husband. And that was based upon the prosecutor saying an out-of-court comment such as, I have heard these things before. I have seen cases like this before where interpreters try to cover up and to try to help out the defense. So that statement brought in an out-of-court declaration about something that the prosecutor, using the force of his office, to suggest to the jury and to the judge that this is the type of things he has seen before and that this is the situation that he has known before from practicing law, whereby interpreters try to help out the defendant. And in this case, Judge, I think that the interpreter, as you could see, was trying to help himself out, trying to show to the court that he was more willing and more able to conform to whatever the court wanted of him, when all the court wanted of him was to translate properly. And instead of saying, I didn't translate that accurately, Judge, he said, I don't think she's understanding what I'm saying. Thank you, Judge.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Casera. Thank you both, counsel.